5 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. I think that probably most people would agree that it is a good thing for college students to have the chance to participate in athletics during the time that they're at school. At the same time, there are a lot of folks, and certainly among them faculty members at colleges and universities, that are worried that athletic programs, particularly big ones, have the potential to undermine the education of their schools. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the recommendations, some of the recommendations coming out of a recent report by an organization called the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics. Now, this what this is it's a national alliance of 55 Division I-A university faculty senates interested in promoting reform of intercollegiate athletics. And our guest for the program for this hour is Nathan Tublitz. He is currently the co-chair of the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics. He is also a neurobiologist in the Department of Biology and in the Institute of Neuroscience at the University of Oregon. And he's been interested in this whole subject of college sports for some time. In fact, as a faculty member there at Oregon, he was part of a team that convinced the administration to eliminate the institutional subsidy for the university's athletic department, which is now one of the few in the country that is financially self-sufficient. As the president of their university senate there, he also, along with the president, established a task force that reviewed the institutional control of the university's intercollegiate athletic program and developed a set of principles and rules governing athletic operations. So we'll be talking a bit, generally speaking, about the subject of college sports and things that perhaps might be changed or should be changed. Professor Tublitz, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Tell me just a little bit about the how it is that the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics came to be. How long has this organization been around?
The Coalition started back in 2002. It evolved, actually, here at the University of Oregon. A couple of faculty got together and were concerned about a particular incident, and that incident was that the university had chosen to move the final football game of the year from its regularly scheduled slot to the weekend before exams, and we were very concerned that that would have a negative impact upon exam performance and obviously classroom, the final grades for the students. So we initiated a movement here, and that led to a discussion across the Pac-10 conference on the issue of athletics, and that in turn led to a joint conversation between the Pac-10 faculty and the Big Ten faculty, and from there we evolved into a national organization.
It seems pretty clear that the driving this was the feeling, your feeling of colleagues, feeling of other people, faculty people at other colleges and universities, the feeling that faculty was not as involved as they should be in trying to determine the relationship between the university and its athletic programs, and particularly in trying to do what can be done to make sure that student athletes are indeed both students and athletes, and primarily students, and perhaps secondarily athletes. Do you think that this was something where, for a long time, faculty were in a sense just standing apart from this and saying, "Well, this really doesn't have anything to do with us"?
I think you've got part of it correct. That's certainly one good answer. The faculty basically gave up the responsibility to control various aspects of the university over the last 20 or 30 years across many campuses in this country, and that's because running a university is complicated, and it requires a lot of effort, and much of it is left to administrators. And we faculty focus on the things that we are best at, which is teaching and research and providing service for the community at large. That said, because of maybe an inadvertent negligence on the part of faculty, we ended up not remaining cautiously overseeing athletics, and the result has been that athletics has slowly drifted away from, in many cases and at many institutions, from the primary mission of the university, which is simply put to educate our students and to provide them with a background and an educational basis that will give them a strong leg up for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that if you talk with university administrators and people who are involved in athletic programs, and I've done it, and I'm sure that other people have done it, they have a way to justify the existence of sports programs, even the big revenue sports programs. They have a way of talking about how of folding it into the educational mission of the university. Now, and I'm sure that there are many people who would say, well, yes, I think it's a good idea for students to be able to participate in sports, intramural sports certainly, and maybe even intercollegiate sports at a very competitive level. But I think they would say there is some line at which you cross it and it becomes impossible anymore. You know, big-time college sports, particularly the big revenue sports like football and basketball, they would say there's some line at which you cross that you can't anymore make the argument that this really is a part of the educational mission of the university. I mean, do you think that I wonder what you think about that and whether you think, in fact, that you can talk about big-time college sports and really be able to say, yes, we can sincerely, honestly, justify these programs and say, yes, they're actually in keeping with the mission of the university.
That's a really good point, David. College sports, so this is my personal opinion, but I believe it's shared by many of my colleagues. College sports has a definite place on the campuses of our university and colleges, be they large universities or small colleges. College sports provides benefits for the individual student-athlete in terms of focus and dedication and leadership skills. It provides sort of a rallying point for the college campus, and it provides a way of bringing together the entire community. So there's a lot of benefits to college sports. However, has been over time a number of problems associated with college sports. So we in the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics, which we use the acronym COIA as an explanation, as a definition of our group, mm-hmm. An acronym, we believe that college sports can coexist very well with the rest of the university, but it needs to have some oversight the same way that any other unit on the university campus has oversight. And that's where we feel faculty can provide the academic foundation for that oversight.
I know that there are a lot of people who think that there are issues in college sports that definitely need to be addressed, and I think that probably the administrators of the NCAA would agree with that, and within the past few years there have been attempts to try to address some of the concerns that people have, and I'm sure that you wouldn't want to say anything bad about the NCAA, but what do you think about that is, after all, supposed to be the oversight body that sets the rules and that tries to make sure that people follow the rules. How well do you think that they have done already in addressing some of these concerns, particularly the concerns you have about the fact that, as I said before, that you want to make sure that student athletes are indeed students and they're held to this, they're essentially treated the same as other students, they're held to the same standards as other students, they're not primarily recruited as athletes, but they come there as students. How well has the NCAA done in trying to make sure that all of those things apply?
Tough question, but a valid one. The NCAA has traditionally been at the helm of intercollegiate athletics, but it's been its membership is all the universities that are associated with the NCAA, and I believe that's a membership number that's in excess of 1,100 universities and colleges in this country. That's a large number of members to try, each with its own different ethos and atmosphere, and that's pretty hard to bring them all together and agree on anything, any direction in any organization of that size. In the case of the NCAA, I think, has tried over the years to focus on academics, but it's not been until the recent president, Miles Brand, at which point the NCAA took a very sharp turn and focused very dramatically on academic reform. The NCAA has instigated a number of reform-minded measures, including increasing the eligibility requirements, the admissions requirements for entering freshmen and transfer students. And they've also put into place something called the APR, the Academic Progress Rate, and the GSR, which is the Graduation Success Rate. Those are two measures which enable or force universities to make sure that their students are moving forward with their academic studies as well as their athletic programs, and making sure that, students, athletes are students first. And so the NCAA should be applauded for the things they have done, but it's a tough organization to run, and my hat's off to Miles Brand, but there's still a lot that can be done, and the proposals that we've made in our paper, for example, raising grade point averages so that they're 2.0, which means a C average to maintain athletic eligibility, we believe is a step further in the direction of maintaining academic integrity.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Nathan Tublitz. He's a neurobiologist in the Department of Biology and the Institute of Neuroscience at the University of Oregon. He is also currently the co-chair of the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics. This is a national alliance of 55 Division 1A university faculty senates who are interested in promoting reform of intercollegiate athletics. It's an organization that's been around since 2002, and it started there at the University of Oregon. He's been interested in these particular issues there at his own school for some time. And we're talking a little bit, or we will talk a little bit, about some of the recommendations that are part of a recently issued report, Framing the Future, Reforming Intercollegiate Athletics, that was put out by COIA, the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics, just not very long ago, within about the last 10 days or so. And if you're interested, you can go to their does COIA itself have a website, or do people need to essentially go through your own personal webpage to
No, COIA does have its own website. It happens to be hosted on the university website. But if you Google COIA, COIA, in capital letters, COIA will be the first thing that comes up, which, of course, is not the same as COAI, which apparently is Clowns of America International. So I think we need to be clear about what you're looking for.
All right. COIA, the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics. Or I'm sure if you could put that into your browser if you're interested in taking a look at this, or some of the other white papers the Coalition has authored that have to do with issues of college sports. And otherwise, here on this program, too, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could talk just a little bit about generally about some of what you're recommending. And it goes back to what I tried very quickly to summarize before. I think the basic idea is that you're wanting to say that student athletes should primarily be students, and that they should meet the same standards. They should be admitted under the same kinds of qualifications. They'd be should expected to perform. That is, everything that applies to a student who is not an athlete should apply to these students as well.
Correct. And we basically start from two underlying principles. One is that the intercollegiate athletics enterprise must be in alignment with the educational mission of the institution, and two, that college sports must adhere to the college athletics model, which is a different model than the professional model, obviously. But the two have gotten, the line between the two have gotten a bit fuzzy over the years, and we're trying to shine a light on that line and bring it more into focus and make sure that college sports is on the, basically on the amateur side of that line.
I guess this would suggest that you think it is a particular problem, that is, that there are schools that recruit students to be athletes really only because they think they have athletic talent, that they want them there as athletes, and that that the standards for admission and what they're expected to do and the kind of coursework that they take, that in a sense a separate kind of category status in de facto has been set up for them. They're not like other students, and that it seems pretty clear that really what they're there for is to play sports and not really to be a student, not
well,
really a student like other students.
You're right, and there's a lot of anecdotal evidence around which suggests that is that situation that you've just described is getting worse rather than better. For example, universities have admissions policies, as we all know, and we admit students based upon a set of criteria. Well, all universities admit a few number of students that don't quite meet that criteria. Students who, for example, art students or music students who may play an instrument very well but don't have the requisite math requirements. And we admit them, but we admit them because we believe that they are going to succeed in school. In the case of student-athletes, in many universities, the student-athlete population, many more of them are admitted than one might expect on a special admit basis, which is what we call those students who are admitted who don't have the criteria to get in normally. Those special admits end up being brought into this university or any university, many universities, and allowed, given an education, but their primary, many of them, the primary purpose is to facilitate their athletic endeavors. And that's where we have a concern. For example, there are many schools where student-athletes are admitted as special admits in a much higher percentage than one might expect based upon their numbers. Here at the University of Oregon, 2% of the student body population are student-athletes, yet we admit over 20% of them as special admits. So, and then many schools and other schools, that number is much higher. And that concerns us because it suggests that maybe we're not looking after the best interest of our students. After all, as faculty, and I know we're pointy-headed, nerdy academics, but as faculty, our real interest is making sure that our students will succeed academically.
And I guess that gets to the question that I'm sure that some people would raise, that question about if indeed this happens, if a university admits a student and admits someone to be an athlete that otherwise they wouldn't because they don't meet minimum qualifications on their educational performance and the belief that they're going to be able to commit, they're going to complete the program, that they will graduate, that they will perform at least to average level, all of those sorts of things. Some people, I think, would ask this question, well, really, who is hurt by this? And I think the answer comes back that, well, perhaps the university is hurt, but certainly this student is hurt because it somehow means that the university is only caring about them as an athlete for what their performance might be on the field. And as a student, as a potential graduate, it makes it look like the university really doesn't care about them at all. They don't really care about what happens to them after school. And do you, in fact, think that that's the case? And is that the kind of thing that you and your colleagues there are really concerned about? That there's the welfare of the student-athlete.
Absolutely. We've heard a number of anecdotal stories that run in the following vein. Student is admitted as a student athlete. Their academic performance is not quite up to snuff, but they're admitted anywhere and they're given a full scholarship. They play for a year and then get injured. That injury takes a year or so to recover from. It's a serious injury. And as a result, that student loses their scholarship. The student may be performing well in the classroom, but because it's lost, that student has lost their scholarship, and because they may not have any other funds to keep them in school, they have to drop out of school. And for us, that's a travesty. As long as the students are maintaining academic progress, they should be given all the tools that are necessary to stay in school, including maintaining keeping their scholarship, despite the fact that they were injured. In other cases, we know of student athletes who are coming into school that are quite poorly prepared for university life, and that is causing all sorts of troubles in the classroom. But instead of fixing those troubles in the classroom or actually not admitting them at all, they're basically passed through the system, and that doesn't do them any good, because although most student athletes think that they're going, especially in the new sports of basketball and football, think that they're going to go to the pros, the numbers are really against them. Less than 1% go to the pros. I mean, there's a good story that we hear here, that we've heard from our football coach here, that he stands at the beginning of the year, he has 100 players, and he stands up and says, how many of you are going to play in the pros? And 98 out of 100 raise their hands. Two of them are probably not even listening. So, but 98 out of 100 are raise their hands. And then he says to them, well, you know, of course, that less than two of you are going to actually make it to the pros. How many of you now think you're going to make it to the pros? They all raise their hands again. The gist of this story is that student-athletes sometimes don't have the maturity or the understanding to make wise choices, and that's one of the reasons that they're in school, and we need to help them make wise choices and need to help them understand that the vast, vast majority of them are not going to go on to professional athletics, and that we need to train them in something that they will go on and succeed in.
Hmm. We have a caller here. Want to bring him into the conversation. Someone listening in Champaign on our line number one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the NBA draft is Thursday, and the top two picks right now they're thinking of are two underclassmen that the real only reason they're in school is to get the exposure and spend a year or two and then be drafted, because the NBA requires that they at least spend 1 year. What's Coya's stand on that kind of policy, and how does the NCAA work? Because they're kind of in cahoots in some ways with the NBA on that policy. So what do you say about that, and what might be a better or a more reasonable way to anticipate that these guys are super athletes, could be making a whole lot of money? Should they even be required to attend school if really that's not their purpose in their career or what they want to do to get out of life? So just wondered what you would what your opinion was on that, and I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Thanks. That's a great question. Of course, being from Eugene, Oregon, and knowing that the number one draft pick is from the Portland Trail Blazers, I probably have a conflict of interest. But that said, the caller brings up an excellent point, and that is that the way the NBA has set up its draft rules, it can only now require students to be, I think, 19 before they're drafted, or 1 year after high school. And in a lot of ways, that's a travesty of what our educational system is about. Many of these players come in to as freshmen. They take minimal number of courses their first term, their first semester. They play basketball, and then all they have to do is just finish out the basketball season, and then they can move on to the NBA. There are people who will claim that that is at least giving them one semester of an education. Coya doesn't have an official policy on this, but I can tell you personally that I think it's a total sham, and the NBA needs to come up with a different set of regulations that allows these players who are incredibly gifted to find another venue to practice before they're drafted, or to change their draft rules. But they shouldn't be coming to college if their primary goal is to go to the NBA.
Yeah. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. I would welcome other callers, questions, comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And let me again introduce our guest, Nathan Tublitz. He's a neurobiologist in the Department of Biology and the Institute of Neuroscience at the University of Oregon. He also is currently the co-chair of the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics. This is a national alliance of 55 Division I-A university faculty senates. It's been around since 2002 and actually started at there at University of Oregon. They're interested in promoting a comprehensive reform of college athletics, intercollegiate athletics. And as we said a moment or so ago, if you're interested in reading a recent report with a number of recommendations, you can go to their website, the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics, and take a look at it. It's Framing the Future, Reforming Intercollegiate Athletics. That's the title. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I know in a sense that we've been over this ground a little bit before here, but I keep thinking about the fact that there are some people who would say that, you know, given the fact that what we have here with the big sports programs, football and basketball, is over time what has developed here is what colleges are doing is, in effect, they are running a farm system for the NFL and the NBA. And that at that level, college sports, it's just irredeemable. There's no way to do anything about that at that level, and that either we have to say, well, if the college is determined to, if they feel that it's necessary to have to compete at that level, fine, they can do it. Otherwise, the other choice is just to get rid of it entirely. That there can't really be much middle ground. Now, I know that it seems to be your feeling and the feeling of the other people in the coalition that there is some kind of middle ground, but it seems difficult to figure out where that would be.
Well, the middle, you're right. I mean, it is hard to find a middle ground, but the middle ground has existed for many years. We had an intercollegiate athletic system that was very much less commercial than it is now, and it, you know, to be frank, it is the commercialization aspect that has driven some of the excesses that we see in college sports at the moment, with coaches getting multi-million-dollar salaries. Something like the top 40 of the 49 United States, of the 50 United States, 49 of them have as their top employee in the state either a college football or basketball coach. So it's a little bit out of whack. That said, we are a moderate group, and we believe that college sports has its place, and it's just a matter of finding that place and finding a middle ground. The other thing that one needs to mention is that almost all the press on college sports, good, bad, or indifferent, is on the major college revenue sports, which is basketball and football. But there's many, many, many other college sports, as we all know, from lacrosse to baseball to wrestling, on and on and on. There are many, many, many student athletes that actually do achieve this middle ground and do it very, very well. So I think one cannot lose sight of the fact that in many sports, the system is working very well. It's just in the large revenue sports where the system is a bit awry.
Let's talk with somebody else here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. Is there any progress being made toward giving these student athletes a stipend? Because it seems to me they must be some of the poorest students because they cannot get a part-time job because they're too busy practicing.
Well, that's a great question because it raises the issue of whether they should be paid. And there is actually a lawsuit currently coming out of ex-UCLA students, a national lawsuit, requesting just that student athletes actually be paid and given a stipend for what they do. The reality is that student athletes actually get a lot. Student athletes get their entire tuition and room and board paid for. They get their food paid for. They get their books paid for. Many Division I-A schools, they get a lot of clothing. They do get a daily allowance.
They do?
They do for expenditures, and they get paid for some of their efforts, especially when they're out of town. And they do get a minimum amount of money. That said, they could go out and get a job. The NCAA rules state that they're not allowed to actually practice as a team more than 20 hours a week. The reality, however, as we all know who have been athletes ourselves or who have children as athletes, is that many student-athletes spend much more time than that on their athletic endeavors. And that's a concern because the more time they spend on their athletic endeavors, the less time they're studying, and the more their focus they're on success on the field and less focused on success in the classroom. And we need to constrain that, and the NCAA is trying to do that through enforcing the 20-hour-a-week rule and also by, as I mentioned earlier, this academic progress rate, which is a very big step forward in making sure that student-athletes perform in the classroom. This is a measure which forces university to, on a term-by-term basis, assess the progress of a student, and if the student doesn't meet eligibility rules or is doing well enough in school, the end result is that universities' teams can lose scholarships, and that's going to hurt them where they need it the most.
Well, thank you.
All right, let's go next to Bloomington, Illinois, line number 2. Hello.
Hello. I just have some concerns about maybe the implications of what you're task is here. Aren't you really, in a way, maybe unintentionally, promoting an image of the big, bad, dumb athlete? And more importantly, what percentage of athletes that you are talking about are African American and come from poor families? And when you differentiate these sports, isn't there a racial economic component that there aren't poor African Americans on the tennis team? So could you address the class and racial dynamic? Finally, answer a question: why colleges are concerned about late affirmative action? That is, and I'll stereotype, the big, dumb, rich, white people getting into colleges who do not have the academic credentials. I'll listen off air. Thank you.
Those are good questions, and they're tough ones, and they're important to be raised, so I'm glad you brought them up. Are we suggesting or implying that there's such a thing as or encouraging the stereotype of a dumb athlete, regardless of their ethnic background? We hope not. What we would like to ensure is that whatever our students are when they enter whatever performance level they are at when they enter the university, that they leave the university with a higher performance level. It doesn't matter whether they started off as a B student. We would like to hope that they end up being an A student or a D student up to a C student. We want to see improvement. We want to see that our students have achieved a higher level, a skill set level, that's independent of what revenue sport they're in, revenue or non-revenue sport. With regard to the issue of socioeconomic status, that's a really important question. We are very concerned that many of the students who are brought in to university on scholarships for student-athlete purposes are indeed come from backgrounds and homes that may not allow them to go to college otherwise. And we want to make sure that if they come to college that they have the ability to succeed. That doesn't necessarily mean that they will succeed, but we want to make sure that they have all the tools that will be necessary to succeed. And if they don't, we want to make sure that we give them those tools. So that means helping them academically, and that takes time. And if all the focus is going to be on athletics, then it begs the question of how they're going to improve academically. The last question you talked about was affirmative action and underprivileged and African-American students, and I don't have the numbers on the tip of my tongue about that. It is clear, however, the NCAA does, and it is clear that there's a high percentage of African-Americans in some of the major revenue sports, and it is our hope that we can continue to bring all peoples and increase our diversity on our campuses, but we want to make sure that by doing that, we allow them to achieve an educational success as well as success on the field.
Again, other questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes in this part of Focus 580-333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned that at the beginning that there at your university, University of Oregon, that you were part of a group of faculty that convinced the administration to eliminate the subsidy to the athletic department. So now the athletic department there is self-sufficient and apparently one of the few that is financially self-sufficient. Was that a very controversial move or a difficult project there?
I mean, the person who spearheaded it was my colleague Jim Earle in the English department, and it was a difficult effort. But the university administration, in their wisdom, was convinced that it would be good for the university and good for both the academic and athletic side for the university athletic program to be self-sufficient. However, there have been some unintended consequences of that decision over the last few years. For example, the university has gone out and actively solicited for monies outside the university and done things like, again, moved football games to the middle of the week instead of on a Saturday, which is traditional for here in the Pac-10, or moving football games to the weekend before exam week, and all of those end up having a negative impact on academics, and that concerns us. We've also just hired a athletic director who doesn't have a college degree, and that concerns us greatly because, in fact, the primary purpose of our student athletes is to stay here and get a degree while at the same time playing and enjoying their sport. So we have had some problems here at the university that have not been solved by becoming self-sufficient. And by the way, just to let you know, there are there's 119 Division I-A schools, and there's, as I said earlier, about 1,100 or more NCAA schools. Of that number, of the 1,100, only 7, according to NCAA numbers, are self-sufficient. That's a very, very, very tiny number. The rest of the schools are actually taking money from their general funds, taking money away from academics, and placing it into athletics.
One more time here. We're moving into our last about 10 minutes. I want to introduce the guest for those who might have just tuned in. Nathan Tublitz is a neurobiologist at University of Oregon. He also is currently the co-chair of the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics. This is a national alliance made up of 55 Division I-A university faculty senates interested in the reform of intercollegiate athletics. It's an organization that's been around since 2002 and actually started there at the University of Oregon. They have recently released a report with a series of recommendations on reforming college sports. And if you're interested in looking at it, you can go to their website. Just go to the put in the Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics into your web browser, or you can put in the initials COIA, and you can find it. And questions here are welcome, too. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit about some of the recommendations about conditions for student athletes, their performance, their admission, those sorts of things. You also, in this report, are interested in promoting greater faculty involvement in setting and regulating athletic policy to the point where you're suggesting that what there should be is a kind of a governing board for the athletics, and that there ought to be faculty on it.
Correct. We've proposed something called a campus athletic board. It's just a committee, and that committee would oversee and monitor campus intercollegiate athletics. Many schools already have this type of board. It has a predominance of faculty on it, and it allows intercollegiate athletics to have the same level of oversight and monitoring that many other parts of the university have in terms of regulating their general views and their focus. So we think that this is in concert with a general trend at a university, at universities these days, to make sure that faculty are involved and involved in not necessarily making the decisions by themselves, but are involved in making the decisions in intercollegiate athletics.
And this doesn't happen already in some way?
Again, remember, as I said, there's 119 Division I A schools and 1,100 schools in general that are part of the NCAA. Many schools have this, but many schools do not. And each school has a different atmosphere. I believe you're associated with the University of Indiana at Bloomington, and you know Bloomington's atmosphere is very different in terms of athletics than it is here at the University of Oregon. And every other school has its unique aspects, and we just want to make sure that there's faculty involvement in athletics so that athletics doesn't continue to drift away from the mission and goals of the university.
Well, just for the record, this is the University of Illinois.
Oh,
Urbana-Champaign.
Excuse me, I apologize. Bloomington.
We are indeed in the Big Ten and all, but no.
Right. That would be
someplace completely different, as they say.
There you go. My apologies.
That's quite all right. That's quite all right. Again, questions, comments from people who are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, what sort of level of optimism do you have that the kinds of recommendations that we have talked about here and that the coalition is putting forward might actually be adopted? Because it's really what I think you're relying on happening here is that rather than being a kind of a top-down sort of thing, this would be the sort of thing that you would, I'm sure, encourage people on individual campuses to say, let us sit down here on our campus, let's talk about what we do right here, and perhaps also talk about how things might change. So I'm sure that you would say, yes, that's really, it's got to be a kind of thing that's going to happen on the particular campus because people there on that campus think that it's important.
Absolutely. It has to be done on individual campuses, but it can't stop there. I mean, the conversation has to begin on campuses, but it has to also happen at the conference level. For example, conferences are the key players in scheduling of athletic events. And it also has to happen nationally. And so COIA is in the process of discussing, having conversations with the NCAA and with other organizations to try and promote and get some of these proposals adopted nationally. At the same time, we're having conversations with various conferences and hopefully at individual levels, at the level of individual campuses through our membership, and having some of the proposals adopted at those levels as well. So it's a multi-prong effort trying to put one's arm around an extremely difficult and somewhat untamed beast called intercollegiate athletics.
Mm-hmm. And any kind of response from particularly from NCAA?
Well, we have been actually in conversation with the NCAA, and they're very supportive of many of our proposals, and we're in the process of beginning conversations and meeting with them to see how we can begin the process of having it adopted at the national level. But the NCAA's legislative and certification process is complex, and it takes some time.
We, I think, are getting another caller lined up here. We do have time for one or possibly two calls in the time that remains. Yes, we have someone here in Urbana. We'll talk with them. Line number one. Hello.
David, I just came into the conversation, but I heard the word NCAA athletics and Indiana University at Bloomington. What can you give me in a thumbnail? What is the nature of this conversation?
Well, what we're doing here is we're talking with this fellow who's involved in this organization that brings together faculty senates from all across the country that are interested in the reform of college athletics. So it's this body. It's a body called the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics, and they put out a report on how they think things should change in college sports. It's something you can read on the web. We've talked a little bit about some of the basics, but that's kind of it.
Well, my concern is two-pronged. One, I think the salaries of Division I-A basketball and football coaches at primetime programs like the Big Ten, the SEC, Big East are totally out of whack when you look at what the salaries are for presidents, chancellors. And I do believe the primary mission of these universities is education, not entertainment, which I think athletics is the embodiment of. And secondly, I'm concerned, especially with men's basketball, with the graduation rates, especially those rates for the people who carry men's basketball Division I-A, that is, persons are who we call African-Americans. Can the speaker address those two issues?
I'm sure that he can. We have touched on that a little bit, but I think it's a good to come back around to those sorts of things. And Professor Tublitz, go ahead.
That question is really hits at the heart of the matter, and I appreciate the call. The issue of entertainment versus academics is key to this entire conversation. It's important to understand that universities are educational missions, not activities that promote entertainment, and that everything within a university needs to be focused on what's best for the educational mission. That includes athletics. We strongly agree with the caller that the salaries structures are completely out of whack. For example, the recent coach appointment at Alabama, where he received, I think, $4 million a year, is about twice the amount of money that is given in that same state to underprivileged youth to go to college. So there's a little bit of an imbalance there. With respect to graduation rates, it's essential that graduation rates increase. We have a number of anecdotal pieces of evidence that some coaches are very interested in making sure that their student athletes graduate, but that many coaches are not, and that we need to make sure that all coaches are on the same page with regard to focusing on graduation and on the academic success of their students, not just success on the field.
Let me ask you this. You know, I know I'm late. Do you have a strategy that would seem to be able to deal what I consider now to be, for lack of a better term, an 800-pound gorilla? I mean, some of this is so entrenched. And I know you're talking about Lou Saban at Alabama, and I believe even at his spring practice game, they had over 95,000 fans to show up for that in Alabama. So there is no love lost for people like you who say Lou Saban shouldn't be receiving $4 million. And I think similar things have happened in college basketball. I think Pertino over at Kentucky, and the Kentucky coaches receive far more than the administrators. I mean, how can you move what seems to be an intractable problem in light of our love affair with these high-profile athletic programs?
I think it's a great point, but the key thing here is to make sure that everybody is on the same page with regard to making sure that academics comes first and that we do everything we can to maintain the mission, values, and goals of our university. The NCAA is doing that with respect to their APR, their academic performance or progress rate, and we're supporting them strongly in making sure that students, athletes, perform in the classroom. And it has to be slow, it has to be steady, but I think we'll be making progress on it. But you should check back and make sure that we do.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks.
Thank you.
I certainly think the caller raises some of the questions we have talked about throughout the course of the program, pointing out just what an uphill battle it is for you and for other people who are faculty at colleges and universities who are concerned about the status of the student athlete and, as we have said a couple of times, about trying to make certain that the student athlete is a student, and as well as being an athlete and a student first. and perhaps an athlete second, and that that person meets the same standards, the same goals, performs up to at least what is the average of his fellow students that are not their weren't brought there primarily to play a sport. You've really got an uphill battle here.
We do, but it's essential. It's a battle for the heart and soul of the university at one level. We have to make sure that we provide opportunities for every athlete and non-athlete on campus, and those opportunities have to be academic. As I said earlier, the vast majority of student athletes do not go on to earn money from their sport, and so we have to prepare them for a career in something else, and that's our job. That's what educational missions are for, and that's what our institutions are designed to do, and we have to uphold those missions.
All right. Well, now, again, we're finish up here, but I want to make sure that people who are listening know that if you're interested in taking a look at the report that we have talked about, Framing the Future, Reforming Intercollegiate Athletics, if you have internet access, you can go to their website, and as the guest suggested, all you need to do is type in the initials, COIA, and you will get to their website, and you can read that report and some of the other reports that they have put out. And our guest, again, Professor Nathan Tublitz. He's co-chair of this group, the Coalition of Intercollegiate Athletics, been around since 2002, started at his school, University of Oregon. This is an alliance of university faculty senates from 55 Division I-A schools across the country interested in reform of intercollegiate athletics. He, in his professional life, is a biologist, neurobiologist, in the Department of Biology and the Institute of Neuroscience at University of Oregon. And Professor Tublitz, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 15 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
And with this midday look at the markets, I'm Jeff Bossert. I'll also be your host for the Afternoon Magazine today. We're in the 1 o'clock hour. We'll have an archive from May. Well, Celeste Quinn's guest was Rebecca Mead, staff writer for The New Yorker, discussing One Perfect Day, the Selling of the American Wedding. In Kansas City at this hour, September wheat is at 651 and a half, up 4. December at 667, up 4 and a quarter. In the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat at 665, up 1. December at 685, up 1 and a half. March at 677 rather, and 3 quarters, up 2 and 3 quarters. September corn at 333 and 3 quarters, up 8. December at 350 and a half, up 7 and a half. March corn, 366 and 3 quarters, up 7 and a half. August soybeans at 836, up 10. September at 844, up 9 and 3 quarters. November at 859 and a quarter, up 9 and a quarter. And the Merck soybean meal at 223.90, up 3.20. August soybean oil at 36.70, up 16. August feeder cattle at 115, down 25. And August live cattle at 92.60, down 77.5. August live cattle at 97.10, down 60. And August lean hogs at 75.22.5, up 65. And at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is at 13,466.34, down 228. The NASDAQ at 25,44.48, down 285. Forecaster Mike Sulla's forecast for Illinois and Indiana: an excessive heat warning is in effect for southwestern and far west central Illinois through Friday.